are trying to solve a difficult problem. But in this case, the ACC is blocking out only the visual inputs to your right hemisphere. That suppression of visual activity allows the ideas generated in the right ASTG to take up the slack and grow stronger so that they may burst into your consciousness. That is why the quality of grit is so important. When you reach an impasse, you may feel frustrated and be tempted to give up, but that is precisely the moment when, if you keep struggling, your ACC may kick into action and your most original ideas can begin to surface. Insights are among the greatest accomplishments of our elastic thought process. And to finally have understood the mechanism that takes us from impasse to insight was a great accomplishment. But Kunios and Beeman made another important discovery. When they looked back at their subjects' brain activity, they could see that sometimes there was distinctive neural activation in those who would go on to solve the problem through a sudden insight, patterns that came long before the insight. In fact, they appeared several seconds before the problem was even presented. The activity apparently reflected an insight mindset. The brains of some subjects appeared to be primed to succeed through insight by their psychological state, which somehow set the conditions in advance for their right hemisphere to be heard. The neural mechanism through which one can take control of that process is not yet understood, but the implication is that you can nurture insight and lay the groundwork for what will later appear to be the spontaneous generation of novel ideas. The key seems to be to approach your problem with a relaxed mind, as opposed to focusing intensely on applying straightforward logic. I experienced that phenomenon when I was a young physicist. I was seeking the answer to a rather complex problem. I had found an unimaginative mathematical approach that I knew would work, but it was involved and tedious. I had been following that approach with great focus for several days and still had a long way to go when Friday evening came along. I had previously asked the woman to dinner that night, so I took pains to relax my mind and I met her at the restaurant. I just ordered linguine when, without warning, an elegant trick for solving my problem with relative ease popped into my consciousness. My focus on the straightforward approach had apparently been interfering with my ability to find that superior method. Now that I'd thought of it, I felt an irresistible urge to work out enough of the mathematical details to confirm that the idea would work. How do you say to a woman that she is captivating, but could she wait 5 minutes while you scrawl some equations on your napkin? I'd wanted a romantic evening, but as she put her hand on mine, my mind was stuck on the geometry of an infinite-dimensional space. I learned the lesson of Kunios and Beeman's work that night. When attacking a tough problem, impatience to make progress can lead one to a suboptimal solution while blocking your ability to find a better one. Adopting a relaxed mindset, on the other hand, can enable original and imaginative answers to emerge. And so, by allowing your mind to loosen up, you can take steps to awaken your ACC and unleash your powers of insight. For those who are interested, one can practice taking control. Just Google Remote Associates Test and take some of the tests you'll find offered online. You can decide, in each instance, whether to focus on an analytical or an elastic approach, and observe the difference in your thinking. Zen and the Art of Ideas. Kunios tells of the time when a Zen Buddhist meditator visited his lab. He asked the man if he wanted to try a series of CRAs. The meditator agreed. His mind was so focused, however, that the odd word associations demanded by the CRAs didn't come easily. Again and again, he failed to produce a solution within the allotted time. He was doing so poorly, Kunios wrote, that he decided to stop the session to spare the man further embarrassment. But before Kunios did so, the meditator finally got one correct. That was followed by another, and then another. From that point forward, he got nearly all of them right. The meditator, noting the failure of his approach, had apparently taken control of his state of mind and stimulated his ACC to broaden his perspective. and he maintained that broad attention state in problem after problem to produce, in the end, an outstanding performance. To appreciate just how impressive that feat was, consider that over the years, having tested hundreds of subjects on CRAs, Kunios had never seen evidence that the practice achieved during a single session can improve the subject's results. Only this meditator, with his enormous awareness of his own thought processes and his great ability to control his mental state, realized the importance of mindset and was able to turn a switch in his brain to bring success. In recent years, neuroscientists have found that the mindfulness of thoughts exercise I presented in Chapter 4, actually a kind of meditation, promotes the abilities the Zen meditator displayed. A 2012 study, for example, showed that such meditation enhances your ability to broaden your focus at will, so that your mind can quickly and freely jump from one idea to another, encompassing both the ordinary and the unconventional. It's no accident that the trait of mindfulness has again surfaced in our discussion. In Chapter 4, I talked about it in the context of freeing yourself from automated thinking. The challenge of insight is the analogous issue of freeing yourself from narrow, conventional thinking. If you are interested in assessing your own degree of mindfulness, you can answer the questions that appear on the PDF. You'll use a 1-6 scale to rate how frequently or infrequently you have each of the everyday experiences listed in the questionnaire there. The possible scores on that questionnaire range from 5 to 30. The average score is about 15, and about 2/3 of all who take the test score in the 12 to the 18 range. Increasing your degree of mindfulness is a good way to encourage insight, but it isn't the only way. You can also cultivate insight by adjusting your external conditions. For example, research shows that sitting in a darkened room or closing your eyes can widen your perspective. So can expansive surroundings, even high ceilings. Low ceilings, narrow corridors, and windowless offices have the opposite effect. And a well-lit room can make it difficult to ignore objects in your surroundings that stimulate mundane thoughts, shoving aside the imaginative musings of your right hemisphere. Being able to think without any kind of time pressure is also beneficial for generating insight. Because if you have to start on something else soon, your awareness of that can pull your mind back to the external world and block an unconscious idea from popping into your consciousness. Perhaps most important, if you are striving for insight, interruptions are deadly. A short phone call, email, or text message can redirect your attention and thoughts, and once you are there, it can take a long while to get back. Even the thought that some message may be awaiting you can have the same effect. So find a secluded spot, turn off your phone, and don't open the email program on your computer. These steps are all useful ways to adjust our environment or circumstances to foster the generation of original ideas and insight. In Part 4, we'll examine the personal qualities that can aid or deter us, and how, contrary to what used to be the traditional wisdom, we can alter our natural style of thinking to better conform to the demands of today's society. Part 4. Liberating Your Brain. Chapter 8. How Thought Freezes Over. Building Lives and Candle Holders. Jonathan Franzen is living his second life. He'd plotted out his first when he married his Swarthmore College sweetheart. His disheveled graying hair, black plastic glasses, and 5 o'clock shadow give him a hip professorial look, which would have been a perfect fit in that original blueprint. "We planned to write literary masterworks that would be published and earn us a reputation," he tells me. "By the time we were in our 30s, we would have good teaching jobs at a nice college and would live in an old Victorian house and have a couple kids and just have a good literary life. Knowing the market for both literature and professors of literature, I found this strangely confident, as if in graduate school I'd made plans to discover a new elementary particle and then settle down to teach at Harvard." But Franzen shows no sign of irony in outlining his thinking. In his young mind, the dream must have seemed attainable. He'd even predetermined the kind of books he would write. My parents had given me the injunction to do something useful for society, he says. His resulting feeling of responsibility had an enormous influence on the way he viewed his talent. I had to make the world a better place, he tells me, and so I imagine that there had to be some sort of social or political critiques embedded in my books, that they had to be about the fate of a city or nation. As may happen with even the best-laid plans, events didn't work out as he'd envisioned. Franzen's first novel, The 27th City in 1988, was met with positive reviews, though not spectacular sales. His second book, Strong Motion, in 1992, had little impact and disappointing sales. His career stalled, and worse, he found it unfulfilling. For Franzen, these were hard times. Something had to change. To reinvent his career, however, Franzen would have to overcome a phenomenon psychologists call functional fixedness. The term refers to the difficulty people have envisioning that a tool traditionally used for one purpose can be gainfully enlisted for another. Consider the following classic experiment. Subjects are given a box of tacks and a book of matches and asked to find a way to attach a candle to a wall so that it burns properly. Typically, the subjects attempt to employ the items in the conventional manner. They try tacking the candle to the wall or lighting it to affix it with melted wax. The psychologists had, of course, arranged it so that neither of these obvious approaches would work. The tacks are too short, and the paraffin doesn't bind to the wall. So how can you accomplish the task? The successful technique is to use the box as a candle holder. You empty it, tack it to the wall, and stand the candle inside it, as you can see in the graphic in your PDF. To think of that, you have to look beyond the box's usual role as a receptacle and reimagine it serving an entirely new purpose. Subjects had a difficult time doing that because their familiarity with the intended use of a box interfered with their ability to envision a new use. That brings us back to Franzen. His tool was his talent, and his fixation arose from that grand vision he developed for his life and his art. Before he could restart his career, he had to see that, like the tack box, his gift of writing could be applied in a different manner, to writing a different kind of book. In the candle experiment, when given a deadline of several minutes, about three-fourths of the subjects failed to find the solution. Young children, when given this or similar puzzles by research psychologists, do much better. In one study, so did the members of a hunter-gatherer tribe in the Amazon forest of Ecuador. Both the children and the hunter-gatherers lacked experience in the normal use of the items provided, which enabled them to perform better than those who had preconceptions about their uses based on long familiarity with them. In life, once on a path, we tend to follow it, for better or worse. What's sad is that if it's the latter, we often accept it anyway, not because we're afraid of change, but because by then we are so accustomed to the way things are that we don't even recognize that they could be different. In the past few chapters, I've talked about the importance of how we frame a problem or issue, and how we generate new ideas and achieve insight into challenges that are stumping us. In this and the next three chapters, we will look at the other side of that coin. What is holding us back, and how can we overcome it? The momentum of thought. In the psychologist's definition, functional fixedness refers to how our usual modes of thought can constrain the breadth of our new ideas in the context of tool use. But that is just one manifestation of a larger issue in the way the human brain deals with unfamiliar situations. One can call that the momentum of thought, for, like a mass in Newton's first law of motion, once our minds are set in a direction, they tend to continue in that direction unless acted upon by some outside force. It holds many of us back, keeps us from seeing the changes that would improve our level of satisfaction in life. More generally, it impedes our ability to think of new approaches and imaginative ideas. In a new circumstance, the momentum of old thinking can condemn you to trying to fit square pegs in round holes. When encountering an unusual challenge, does your mind create an appropriately novel response, or do you stick with familiar ideas and concepts? Do you see a tack box as an object full of potential, or do you see it as merely a receptacle for holding tacks? A new or changed situation may provide the force needed to alter the direction of your thinking. For some of us, all that is required is a tiny nudge. Others need to run into a brick wall. Franzen ran into the wall. After the failure of strong motion, his marriage, more than a decade old, began to fail. Then his father became ill with Alzheimer's. The series of events brought years of discouragement and depression, but they also brought him some good, because all the disruptions liberated him from his fixed way of thinking about himself. With regard to his career, he began to see that the tool of his writing talent, like the psychologist's box of tacks, could be employed in a manner he'd never before imagined, and that new freedom completely transformed him as a writer. "I realized I was trying to be the kind of writer that I wasn't best at being," he says, "so I abandoned my notion about the novel's place in the world and decided I could write about the problems of a set of characters rather than those of society." When Franzen speaks, his words are measured, and this sounds as much like a statement about the philosophy of literature as it does a personal revelation. But the change he's describing was enormous. Over time, the operational implications of Franzen's realization fell into place. He stopped worrying about writing for the masses and realized he should write for people who particularly love good books. It would be enough if he could give those readers a good time, give them insight into the kinds of issues we all face, and make them feel less alone. "I began to construe my novels as a series of interlocking modules," he says, "each focused on the arc of one character, and I stopped worrying about creating plots with high stakes. My biggest breakthrough was realizing that I could build an entire book around the question, will a woman get her family together for Christmas?" It was a huge shift in approach, but it worked. In 2001, Franzen published The Corrections to great acclaim, and his career has thrived ever since. He became America's best-selling writer of literary fiction, won a National Book Award, and landed on the cover of Time with the headline, "Great American Novelist." In the preface to his 1936 book, General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, economist John Maynard Keynes wrote, "The ideas which are here expressed so laboriously are extremely simple and should be obvious. The difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping from the old ones, which ramify into every corner of our minds." Franzen's success is a parable of liberation, a story of the benefits of elastic thinking, of the potential we can achieve. The lesson is that by letting go of our fixed ways, we can accomplish goals we might never have thought possible. When thought freezes over. At the turn of the 20th century, famed physicist Sir James Jeans helped derive a theory of a phenomenon called blackbody radiation. He based his theory on Newton's laws and the well-established theory of electromagnetic forces. It was a beautiful theory, stemming from well-established physics. But when he compared its predictions with experimental data, the theory failed miserably. Today we know that Jeans' mathematical recipe was sound. It was just not meant to be applied to the ingredients he was cooking with. Newton's laws are not valid for atoms, and it is the motion of atoms that creates blackbody radiation. About the time Jeans was creating his theory, an obscure physicist named Max Planck cooked up something different, based on an alteration to Newton's laws that he had invented. He called it the quantum principle. Unlike Jeans' theory, Planck's novel recipe resulted in predictions that matched the experimental data beautifully. When asked about this, Jeans admitted that Planck's theory worked and his didn't. But, he added, he believed his theory was correct anyway. Had you asked Sir James Jeans a question about almost any topic in physics, you would have gotten a brilliant answer. But with regard to his own failed theory, he sounded like a used car salesman insisting that the transmission isn't really that important. The political theorist Hannah Arendt defined frozen thoughts as deeply held ideas and principles that we long ago developed and no longer question. In Arendt's eyes, the complacent reliance on such accepted truths was akin to thoughtlessness, something like the automatic scripted behavior of the mother goose, a computer, or a human operating on autopilot. People operating according to the dictates of frozen thoughts may be powerful processors of information, but they blindly accept ideas that conform to their frozen thoughts and resist accepting non-conforming ideas even when there is ample evidence for them. Frozen thinking occurs when you have a fixed orientation that determines the way you frame or approach a problem. Our challenge is to turn off that mode of mental operation, to defrost and re-examine our frozen thoughts when it is appropriate. Arendt called the kind of thinking we engage in when we rise above frozen thought critical thinking. To Arendt, who was interested in the origins of evil, thinking critically was a moral imperative. In its absence, a society can go the way of Nazi Germany, a risk that is still present in many countries today. And yet, Arendt noticed, a surprising number of people don't think critically. The inability to think critically is not stupidity, she wrote. It can be found in highly intelligent people. It is ironic that frozen thinking is a particular risk if, like Sir James Jeans, you are an expert at something. When you are an expert, your deep knowledge is obviously of great value in facing the usual challenges of your profession. But your immersion in that body of conventional wisdom can impede you from creating or accepting new ideas, and it can hamper you when you are confronted with novelty and change. In my years in science, I have heard many colleagues complain that the experts who referee papers sometimes approach them from a fixed point of view and proceed to misunderstand what they read because they approach the material hurriedly, thinking that they already know what the authors are trying to say. Just as an experienced golfer can have difficulty altering the much-rehearsed stroke that is encoded in his motor cortex, so too may a professional thinker have difficulty shedding the conventional ways of thinking lodged in her prefrontal cortex. Or, as the photographer Dorothea Lange wrote, to know ahead of time what you are looking for means you're then only photographing your own preconceptions, which is very limiting and often false. Frozen thinking has plagued the careers of scientists and ruined the health of many a business. But one context in which it is truly dangerous is medicine, and public health researchers have only recently begun to uncover the ramifications. For example, if you land in the hospital, it's natural to want to be treated by the most experienced physicians on staff. But according to a 2014 study, you'd be better off being treated by the relative novices. The study appeared in the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. It examined 10 years of data involving tens of thousands of hospital admissions and found that the 30-day mortality rate among high-risk acute care patients was a third lower when the top doctors were out of town, for example, when they were away at conferences. The JAMA study didn't pinpoint the reasons for the decreased death rate, but the authors explained that most errors made by doctors are connected to a tendency to form opinions quickly, based on prior experience. In cases that are not routine, that can be misleading, because the expert doctors may miss important aspects of the problem that are not consistent with their initial analysis. As a result, though junior doctors may be slower and less confident in treating run-of-the-mill cases, they can be more open-minded in handling unusual cases or treating patients with subtler symptoms. That alarming finding supported another bold study published in an obscure Israeli medical journal. The question addressed in that research was whether doctors mired in frozen thought might prescribe drugs too readily and without enough scrutiny of the specific circumstances of the individual patients. In particular, a doctor on autopilot might not give due consideration to the interactions of new drugs with the many other drugs a patient is already taking. To probe that possibility, the scientists enlisted 119 patients in geriatric nursing homes. Their subjects had been taking an average of 7 medications each day. With careful monitoring, the researchers discontinued about half the medicines. No patient died or suffered serious side effects from stopping the drugs, and almost all reported an improvement in health. Most important, the death rate among those in the study was far lower than that of a control group whose members had continued their medications. It is medical dogma that medications extend life, but that can backfire when doctors are frozen in the textbook approach to all patients. The kind of elastic thinking that doctors and the rest of us who might be expert in something need to strive for was illustrated well by a simple case study that appeared in another JAMA article. A 6-year-old boy was brought to the pediatrician for behavioral problems. After speaking to the mother and the boy, the pediatrician concluded that the symptoms indicated a diagnosis of ADHD, and he wrote a referral for psychoeducational testing. Then the mother mentioned in passing that the boy, who was asthmatic, had been coughing a lot lately and using his asthma inhaler more often than usual in order to try to control it. Rather than allowing his prior diagnosis to close his mind, the doctor absorbed this new piece of evidence. Hyperactivity can be a side effect of the medication in the asthma inhaler. He postponed the testing and prescribed an asthma control medication so that the boy would not have to use the inhaler as frequently. As it turned out, that solved the problem. Destructive doctrine. Some of the most tragic but enlightening examples of frozen thinking come from the annals of war. The military is particularly vulnerable to frozen thinking because, in the military, expert and authoritative thought is institutionalized. The military operates according to strict rules dictated from the top according to the generally accepted principles and passed down through orders to the ranks. In the military, says General Stanley McChrystal, we have a doctrine of military operations. The longer you operate under that doctrine, the greater the danger that you become shaped by it. McChrystal should know. He spent more than 30 years in the Army, rising to the rank of 4-star general. He finished his career as commander of U.S. and international forces in Afghanistan and of the Joint Special Operations Command, which put him over the Delta Force, Rangers, and Navy SEALs, the teams that conduct our most secret missions and most of the high-profile operations that make the headlines. Among others, McChrystal oversaw the units that captured Saddam Hussein and tracked down Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. McChrystal is credited with revolutionizing modern warfare with his tactics of invading not just enemy positions, but also their phones and computers, and streamlining the decision-making process required to order such raids. The enemy was not saddled with a heavy bureaucracy, and if we wanted to keep up with them, we couldn't be either. As McChrystal's successor, General David Petraeus, told me, today, it is often the side that adapts the fastest that prevails. And so, where other wars were fought on the basis of the lessons learned from conflicts fought decades earlier, successful warfare now requires that you create your theories of battle on the fly. Petraeus, for instance, wrote a counterinsurgency guidance document that he kept on his laptop and updated weekly. One of the challenges for both McChrystal and Petraeus was the need to coax their commanders into embracing this more improvisational approach. McChrystal tells me he understands the hesitancy of those who had trouble with the new ways. He knows there was comfort in obeying the old accepted military doctrine. You feel you can't go too wrong. After all, doctrine is based on the lessons of history. But to rely on a fixed doctrine is a false comfort, and a dangerous one. It can lead to disaster if conditions change and the doctrine doesn't. As I talk to McChrystal about historical examples of frozen thinking, we turn to the Yom Kippur War, which began when adjacent Arab states staged a surprise attack on Israel on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur on October 6, 1973. The tale has since become a classic in the fields of political and military psychology, Alongside the surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, the German attack on the Soviet Union in June 1941, and the frenzy of miscalculation and misjudgment that led to World War I. McChrystal talks about the first signs that might have served as a warning to Israel. They came that August, when Israeli military intelligence reported that her northeastern neighbor, Syria, was moving Russian anti-aircraft missiles to the border on the Golan Heights. Then, in late September, Syria began a massive mobilization, deploying an unprecedented amount of artillery to the Golan. The movement of one armored brigade in particular should have raised eyebrows. The brigade had been stationed to keep peace at the Syrian city of Homs. Removing it was dangerous because the city was a hotbed of Islamic opposition to the ruling regime. In fact, a decade later, the Syrian military would be forced to conduct a major operation there, killing an estimated 15,000 of the city's inhabitants. As these events were unfolding to the north, to the south, Egypt was mobilizing reserve soldiers and transporting them to its border with Israel along the Suez Canal. Convoys arrived daily, including several hundred ammunition trucks. Meanwhile, the reserves paved roads in the desert and worked into the night preparing structures that overlooked the Israeli positions, and descents from which they could lower boats that could cross the canal. By the start of Yom Kippur, a day on the Jewish calendar, when all normal activity ceases and Jews go to their temples and synagogues to pray, Syria had an 8-to-1 advantage in tanks and an even greater advantage in artillery and infantry. Egypt had 100,000 soldiers and 2,000 artillery pieces and heavy mortars on the west bank of the Suez Canal. Israel had 450 men and 44 artillery pieces spread over 100 miles on her side of it. Why didn't the Israelis see that huge buildup, which they were aware of, as a threat? The essence of military deception, McChrystal tells me, is to figure out what the enemy is preset to believe and to play to that. Israel didn't connect the dots because they believed that the Arabs did not want to risk losing another war. The Arabs counted on that Israeli assumption and explained away the buildup as merely a joint training exercise. If it had been, it would have been one of unprecedented scope. But the two Israeli men in military intelligence, who were responsible for assessing such threats and communicating them to the leadership, Major General Eli Zeira and Lieutenant Colonel Yonah Banman, didn't grasp what was happening. These highly intelligent, well-trained, and experienced officers accepted the military exercise explanation for the events and discounted the likelihood of an attack, despite the fact that the Syrian and Egyptian leaders had on many occasions loudly and publicly declared their goal of destroying Israel. For each seeming anomaly in the exercise scenario, Zeira and Banman had an explanation, their frozen thinking blinding them to what should have been obvious. As a result, in the early afternoon of October 6th, Israel was faced with a massive surprise attack on two fronts. The first 2 days sent Israel reeling. By the evening of October 8th, with Arab forces closing in from both the north and the south, Israeli Minister of Defense Moshe Dayan told Prime Minister Golda Meir that the State of Israel, quote, is going under. But eventually Israel beat the odds. By the time a ceasefire was agreed to on October 24th, Israel's forces had progressed to within 20 miles of Damascus and 100 miles of Cairo, causing the Soviet Union to threaten to send troops to support the Egyptians and the United States to respond by putting its nuclear forces on a higher state of alert. After the war, Israel set up a top-level committee, the Agranat Commission, to study how its leaders could have ignored the overwhelming evidence of an impending attack. They concluded that plentiful evidence of an impending attack had been gathered, but that the intelligence establishment had misinterpreted it because of their prior beliefs. The commission concluded that the most important cause of the intelligence failure was the unswerving faith in a doctrine that was so central to their analysis that it was called simply Ha-Concepcia, the concept. The concept emerged from intelligence reports detailing secret assessments made by Egypt's leaders after the Six-Day War of 1967, in which the Israeli Air Force had been decisive in its lightning victory. It asserted that Egypt would not start another war with Israel before gaining air superiority. Since the Israelis had a larger air force than the Arab states, their belief in the concept translated to strong confidence that the Arabs would not dare attack. Unfortunately for the Israelis, the Arabs had reinterpreted what air superiority meant. To the Israelis, superiority meant having a bigger air force. But the Arabs believed they had achieved it by acquiring more anti-aircraft missiles. Arab thinking had changed, McChrystal tells me, and the Israelis hadn't noticed. Due to the Israelis' adherence to the concept and their failure to understand that the terms had changed, their intelligence leadership managed the considerable feat of ignoring evidence of an intention to invade that was so clear and obvious any novice would have spotted it. McChrystal tells me that the lesson of the Yom Kippur War mimics the challenges we faced in the Middle East since our invasion to al-Saddam. We expected the terrorists to have certain limitations. We went in with an almost formulaic approach, like the old Green Bay Packers with their scripted but successful series of plays. But then we ran into Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a nimble and decentralized band of terrorists. They were a constantly changing organism that adapted quickly, McChrystal explains, and so our strategy soon became ineffective. In that environment, the answers that worked yesterday probably won't work tomorrow. We had to learn to be as flexible as they were. But when you ask a culture that has been very successful to change, it requires some shaking. Shaking things up is precisely what McChrystal did. He far exceeded the authority anyone would have presumed he had, one of his colleagues, General James Warner, told me. He disassembled the organizations and reassembled them. When he was done, he'd collapsed what we would normally consider months-long decision cycles into just hours. Unfortunately for McChrystal, his penchant for voicing his disagreements with others openly, and sometimes crudely, got him in trouble with the White House, and he was fired in 2010 by then-President Obama. But he had left his mark. His legacy, as a Forbes magazine piece on leadership put it, is that he created, quote, a revolution in warfare that fused intelligence and operations. To McChrystal, though, it was a simple matter of applying elastic thinking. Weak commanders look for prepackaged answers, he tells me. Strong leaders adapt. Handicapping the expert brain. If expertise can impede your thinking in situations of novelty or change, then how big is that influence? In the JAMA study, researchers suggested that less expert doctors might be superior in diagnosing and treating unusual cases, but the researchers didn't study the relationship between, say, the number of years of experience, and the size of that effect. Amazingly, at least in one context, psychologists were able to quantify such a relationship, and the magnitude of the influence was startling. The context the psychologists studied was the game of chess. They began by showing their subjects board positions of the type one might find in a chess magazine or book. These are diagrams illustrating where the pieces are in the midst of a hypothetical game. The board positions are designed so that one player has the upper hand and can force a checkmate if he makes the proper sequence of moves, called a combination. By force, I mean that no move his opponent can make will prevent the checkmate. The challenge for the magazine reader is to find the winning combination. A chess game is not a short affair. If you open a bottle of wine at the start of one, you might have vinegar by the time it's over. Chess aficionados can also discuss at length the elegance of the way a game was won. In the experiment, some subjects were shown a board position in which white could win in just one way, through a clever sequence of three moves. I'll call that the one solution board. Others were shown a board position in which two different winning combinations were possible. The clever one I just mentioned, plus another that is easier to find, but that chess connoisseurs would consider inelegant. I'll call that the two-solution board. Would the presence of the easy-to-see inelegant solution hamper players from discovering the clever, elegant one? The researchers found that, given enough time, all the players shown the one solution board would find the clever checkmate. But those presented with the two solution board had great difficulty finding that same set of moves. Once the players had found the familiar, obvious checkmate, they were impeded from seeing the shorter, elegant one, even though they'd been told it existed and searched for a long time. That is classic frozen thinking, analogous to the other examples I've discussed. What made this study special was that scientists were able to quantify the correlation between how expert the players were and how much dumber their expertise made them with regard to discovering the unusual, clever solution. The key to quantifying the effect is that chess players have a numerical rating system. They have the convenient habit of playing other chess experts of known strength, keeping careful records of who beats whom, and awarding points accordingly. Translated to probability of winning, the system says that if you play someone 200 points above you, your chances of winning are just 25%. If you play someone 400 points above you, they are only 9%. When scientists compared the performances of those at different point levels on the 1 and 2 position problems, they found that the presence of the routine extra solution produced a dumbing down equivalent to 600 rating points. That difference is enormous. Translated to intelligence testing, for example, it amounts to a 45-point difference in IQ. That's food for thought. Sometimes when the experts fail, the answer is to call in a novice. Physicist James Jeans, the Israeli intelligence officers, the top doctors, and the expert chess players were all snared by a similar trap. Whether our knowledge bank encompasses the theories of physics, or strategies of war and peace, or chess maneuvers, or anything else for that matter, what we know can put a constraint on the possibilities we can imagine. Having a depth of knowledge is usually desirable, but how can experts battle frozen thinking? The benefits of discord. When psychologists study frozen thinking, they call it dogmatic cognition. In the psychologist's definition, it is, quote, the tendency to process information in a manner that reinforces the individual's prior opinion or expectation. Zen Buddhism has a concept for a style of thought diametrically opposed to dogmatic cognition. It is called beginner's mind. It refers to an approach in which you have a lack of preconceptions and perceive even routine situations as if you are encountering them for the first time, without automatically making assumptions based on your past experience. That doesn't mean you discard your expertise, but that you remain open to new experience despite it. Most of us have a cognitive style that falls somewhere between the extremes of a beginner's mind and dogmatic cognition. The ideal expert in any field is one who has a great breadth and depth of knowledge, and yet maintains, to a large extent, a beginner's mind. Unfortunately, gaining expertise can make it more difficult to process new information with an open mind. As one scientist wrote, social norms dictate that experts are entitled to adopt a relatively dogmatic, closed-minded orientation. As a result, he added, self-perceptions of high expertise elicit a more closed-minded cognitive style. We probably all know people like that. Fortunately, psychologists have found that you can move your thinking away from the dogmatic cognition end of the spectrum. One of the most effective ways is to introduce a little discord to your intellectual interactions. Consider a study performed a half century ago by Serge Moscovici, a Holocaust survivor who went on to study group psychology. Moscovici showed two groups of volunteers a sequence of blue slides. In the control group, after each slide, he asked the individuals, one by one, to state the color of the slide and estimate its brightness. In the experimental group, he had planted some Confederates, actors who called the color green rather than blue. Whom were they fooling? Nobody. The experimental subjects ignored the deviant responses. When their turns came, they all answered blue, just as the control group had. Afterward, Moscovici asked all the volunteers to participate in what he said was a second, unrelated experiment. But it wasn't unrelated. In fact, the earlier experiment was just the setup for the second experiment, which was the one that counted. In that experiment, all the subjects were asked to classify, this time privately and in writing, a series of paint chips as either green or blue, even though their color lay somewhere between those two pure colors. In this experiment, those who had earlier been in the control group responded quite differently from those who had been in the experimental group. Those who'd been in the experimental group identified as green many chips that those who had been in the control group called blue. On the color spectrum, the colors from green to blue form a continuum. Starting with green, they proceed through successively more bluish greens, through the greenish blues, and finish at blue. The second experiment was essentially a test of where you draw the line, separating greens and blues. Amazingly, the experimental group's exposure to the earlier misidentification of blue as green had shifted their judgment. Compared with the control group, they were more open to seeing a color as green. Think about that. Not a single subject had been convinced by the earlier misidentification, yet they were influenced by it. They had been subconsciously persuaded to slide the line of demarcation between colors over toward the green. What does this say about human thought? Even if you're not consciously open to considering opposing points of view, with a little exposure, they can affect your thinking. Other experiments show that dissent can not only sway us with regard to the issue at hand, it can also act to thaw frozen thinking in contexts unrelated to that in which the dissension was voiced. Yes, as distasteful as it is beneficial to talk to people who disagree with us. So if you hate conspiracy theories and run into someone who believes that we faked the moon landing and that Einstein plagiarized relativity from his mailman, don't tell him your life is a cruel joke and walk away. Have tea with him. It can broaden your style of thinking, and it's cheaper than seeing a therapist. Unfortunately, those who suffer most from dogmatic cognition may be reluctant to listen to opposing opinions. Even worse, if they are in positions of authority, they often punish those who have them. Take the Israeli intelligence officers who overlooked the signs of impending war. Major General Zaira told officers who warned that conflict was likely that they should not expect promotion. Lieutenant Colonel Bonman was famous for rejecting any suggestion that he change even a single word in any document he wrote. It's obvious that allowing dissent and carefully considering it could have helped their thinking. That's one of the benefits reaped by universities and corporations that seek diversity in their students and employees. In addition to whatever brilliant ideas those individuals might bring with them, the mere presence of those with other points of view creates a spirit that encourages liberation from deeply ingrained assumptions and expectations. It promotes the consideration of more options and leads to better decision-making. It builds an atmosphere in which people can better respond to change. That was one of the Agronaut Commission's central conclusions, that to avoid the mistakes of frozen thinking, Israeli intelligence needed to restructure in a manner that fostered dissent and invited unconventional ways of viewing situations and events. As we experience the world, we learn useful facts and valuable lessons, and we form a point of view. Over time, we add to and adjust that point of view, much as we might add on to or update our house over the years. But just as we'd hesitate to add a contemporary wing to an old Victorian home, we resist making changes to the edifice of our worldview if those changes don't seem in harmony with what is already there. And yet, in this rapidly evolving world, that is often what is called for. And so, it is one of life's ironic truths that, though we love to be right, we are better off if sometimes people tell us we are wrong. Chapter 9. Mental Blocks and Idea Filters. When Believing Means Not Seeing. When I was an impressionable child, My father told me of a Yiddish saying that he'd come to value in his own younger days as an underground fighter during World War II. In English, the saying translates to something like, when a worm sits in horseradish, it thinks there's nothing sweeter. To that, my father added, and if the worm sits there long enough, everything looks like horseradish. Those are simple sentiments about the mental barriers that stand in the way of imagining things being different from the way they are or have always been. For my father, who fought in the resistance during World War II, those barriers were a useful tool when trying to hide fugitives or events from the Nazis. I pondered that principle of human thinking one night while I was at an academic conference on an old estate in rural England. A bunch of us who'd been drinking got pulled into a late-night Monopoly game. To break the tedium, everyone was talking a great deal, but I decided to use the game to test my father's folk wisdom. In Monopoly, there is a bank, which is the game box. It holds neat stacks of the various bills of play money, in denominations from $1 to $500. It's common practice to occasionally reach into the bank to make change, or to ask someone to reach in to change a bill for you. Everyone was so habituated to seeing players do this that I wondered if they were drowning in horseradish. Would they notice if I practiced a slight variation on the usual change-making? I decided that when I reached into the bank, I would casually deposit a $20 or $50 bill, but withdraw a few $100 bills. I did it in plain sight and waited for someone to call me on it. No one did, and so the bank became my ATM. Unfortunately, one can't perform the same feat with a real ATM, so it was one of those experiments scientists sometimes conduct that have no direct practical application. When I confessed after winning the game, some of my colleagues didn't believe me. They'd become blind to what transpired around them, and they couldn't accept the idea that they had failed to see something so obvious. They'd never have overlooked such larceny, they insisted. Why didn't they notice? I had observed my fellow players gazing at me as I was making my phony change, so I knew that their eyes had registered my actions, and that their primary visual cortex would have recorded it. But the scene was never passed to their conscious awareness. Our conscious brains can process about 40 to 60 bits per second, roughly the information content of a short sentence. Our unconscious has a much greater capacity. Your visual system, for example, can handle about 10 million bits per second. As a result, your primary visual cortex can pass only a small fraction of what it registers to your conscious mind. And so, between your vast unconscious sensory perception and your limited conscious awareness stands a system of cognitive filters. Those filters make their best guess regarding what is relevant or important. They pass that along to our awareness and censor the rest. The brains of my fellow Monopoly players didn't flag my actions because one of the factors our filters rely upon in deciding what is important is our expectations. That is rooted in our beliefs and our past experience of the world. As a result, events that appear routine tend to be rated as less important than novel events or changing circumstances which might present danger or opportunity. Because my behavior was similar to routine activity, and no deviations were expected, no one noticed. As the work of Kunios and Beeman suggested, our ideas are subject to an analogous filtering process. That's necessary because the human unconscious is extraordinarily good at making associations. Say you ponder whether you want spaghetti for dinner. You associate spaghetti with bolognese, bolognese with Bologna, and Bologna with Italy, and soon you are thinking about Botticelli's Birth of Venus. You also associate spaghetti with meatballs, and meatballs with sub-sandwiches, and that gets you going on nuclear submarines. Such cascades of association lead to showers of new ideas. You could make that bolognese sauce you once had in Italy. You could fly to Bologna for dinner. You could dine on a nuclear submarine. Some of your ideas are useful, some are not. And if your divergent thinking, the production of unusual or original ideas, went unchecked, you would drown in unproductive thoughts. Our unconscious filters work quickly and effortlessly with the purpose of suppressing ideas that aren't useful and allowing you to stay focused on the more promising ones. If you are tiling your bathroom, you might consider marble or granite or linoleum, but not coal or peppermint patties or newspaper, because your unconscious has eliminated possibilities that appear to be unhelpful. The downside of the filtering process is that just as the Monopoly player's unconscious minds did not choose to bring my actions to anyone's attention, the filtering of ideas sometimes prevents some good ones from getting through. Our brains may make unusual and useful associations, only to have them discarded. The ideal level of filtering would censor peppermint patty tiles while still allowing unusual possibilities that are worth considering, such as bamboo or rubber. In this chapter, we'll examine how our idea filters work and their role in inhibiting the breakout thinking that is so often required if we are to thrive in society today. Thinking outside the box. Clarence Saunders' fortune came from the grocery business. He got his first job at age 9, working school holidays in a general store. 10 years later, he started selling wholesale food. Then, one day in the late summer of 1916, a department store that wanted to open a grocery asked Saunders to travel from his home in Tennessee to Terre Haute, Indiana, to spy on a store that was rumored to have an innovative design. Grocery stores in 1916 still operated as they had in the 19th century. Despite the fact that manufacturers had by then invented techniques that made possible canned and prepackaged items, so that everything wouldn't have to be stored in vats and bins, stores continued to keep all their goods behind the counter. This meant that customers had to tell the store clerks what they wanted and then wait for them to pick out, price, and bag the goods. During slow hours, store clerks often had little to do. During busy hours, they were overwhelmed, causing long lines and keeping customers waiting. The inefficiencies made the grocery business a bad investment, which was why the department store sent Saunders on a fact-finding mission to see if there was a better way of doing things. But at the store in Terre Haute, Saunders found no magic that would make it more profitable. On the long, hot train ride home, Saunders stared out at the monotonous fields of wheat and corn, the livestock, the dusty small towns. These were common sights that he had seen many times before and ordinarily would have paid no conscious attention to. Despondent, he was ruminating over the wasted trip when his train slowed alongside a pig farm, where a mother sow stood with her 6 piglets feeding. It was an unremarkable scene in the horseradish of the Midwestern countryside, but to Saunders, it was as if someone had shoved in his face a blueprint to save the grocery business. The piglets were serving themselves. Why not let human customers help themselves? If you redesign the grocery stores, customers could pull their own goods from shelves. Saunders, like everyone else in the grocery business, had thought of it within a fixed point of view that precluded his mind from considering a new system of serving customers. But that scene, at the pig farm, presented him with the image of a new and better way. Upon his return, he told the department store of the failure of his mission, but he didn't tell them of his vision. Instead, over the next few months, he invented the items that he would need to carry it out. Shopping baskets, price labels, aisles with shelves and displays, front-of-store checkout counters. All of these items that we take for granted today did not then exist. Saunders opened his first grocery in 1916, and in 1917 he obtained a patent for his new store design. He named his chain after the piglets, calling his stores Piggly Wiggly. Within 6 years, he had 1,200 Piggly Wigglies in 29 states and was a very wealthy man. The chain still exists today, with most of its stores in the South. Saunders' idea, like the answer to any riddle, is obvious once you've been told it. But if that idea had appeared in the brain of any grocery executive before him, it had apparently not been considered promising enough to be delivered to that individual's conscious awareness. The most brilliant entrepreneurs of the day, anxious to fix the problems in the grocery business, willing even to send a spy to steal trade secrets, all failed to invent it themselves. How does the brain's idea filter work? And how can we overcome the censoring when that is appropriate? Real-life problems like the one Saunders solved are too complex to analyze through controlled scientific experiment. But For studying the mechanics of how people come to think outside the box, scientists have found more abstract problems whose solutions demand essentially the same skill. One of the